that he becomes exasperated, and secretly claws the air with an impotent vindictiveness expressive of an intense desire to tear and rend the visage of Mr. George. As the excellent old gentleman's nails are long and leaden, and his hands lean and venous, and his eyes green and watery, and over and above this, as he continues, while he claws, to slide down in his chair and to collapse into a shapeless bundle, he becomes such a ghastly spectacle, even in the accustomed eyes of Judy, that the young virgin pounces at him with something more than the ardour of affection, and so shakes him up and pats and pokes him in divers parts of his body, but particularly in that part which the science of self-defence would call his wind, that in his grievous distress he utters enforced sounds like a pavia's rammer. When Judy has by these means set him up again in his chair, with a white face and a frosty nose, but still clawing, she stretches out her wizened forefinger and gives Mr. George one poke in the back. The trooper, raising his head, she makes another poke at her esteemed grandfather, and having thus brought them together, stares rigidly at the fire.
Chatters Grandfather Smallweed, swallowing his rage. "My dear friend,"
still clawing.
"I'll tell you what," says Mr. George, "if you want to converse with me, you must speak out. I'm one of the roughs, and I can't go about and about. I haven't the art to do it. I'm not clever enough. It don't suit me. And when you go winding round and round me,"
says the trooper, putting his pipe between his lips again,
"damn me if I don't feel as if I was being smothered."
And he inflates his broad chest to its utmost extent, as if to assure himself that he is not smothered yet.
"If you have come to give me a friendly call," continues Mr. George, "I'm obliged to you. How are you? If you have come to see whether there's any property on the premises, look about you. You're welcome. If you want to out with something, out with it."
The blooming Judy, without removing her gaze from the fire, gives her grandfather one ghostly poke.
"You see, it's her opinion too. And why the devil that young woman won't sit down like a Christian," says Mr. George, with his eyes musingly fixed on Judy, "I can't comprehend."
"She keeps at my side to attend to me, sir," says Grandfather Smallweed. "I am an old man, my dear Mr. George, and I need some attention. I can carry my years. I'm not a brimstone poll parrot,"
snarling and looking unconsciously for the cushion,
"but I need attention, my dear friend."
"Well,"
returns the trooper, wheeling his chair to face the old man.
"Now then."
"My friend in the city, Mr. George, has done a little business with a pupil of yours."
"Has he?"
says Mr. George.
"I'm sorry to hear it."
"Yes, sir." Grandfather Smallweed rubs his legs. "He is a fine young soldier now, Mr. George, by the name of Carstone. Friends came forward and paid it all up, honourable."
"Did they?"
returns Mr. George. "Do you think your friend in the city would like a piece of advice?" "I think he would, my dear friend, from you."
"Advise him, then, to do no more business in that quarter. There's no more to be got by it. The young gentleman, to my knowledge, is brought to a dead halt."
"No, no, my dear friend. No, no, Mr. George. No, no, sir,"
remonstrates Grandfather Smallweed, cunningly rubbing his spare legs.
"Not quite a dead halt, I think. He has good friends, and he is good for his pay, and he is good for the selling price of his commission, and he is good for his chance in a lawsuit, and he is good for his chance in a wife, and, oh, do you know, Mr. George, I think my friend would consider the young gentleman good for something yet,"
says Grandfather Smallweed, turning up his velvet cap and scratching his ear like a monkey. Mr. George, who has put aside his pipe and sits with an arm on his chair back, beats a tattoo on the ground with his right foot, as if he were not particularly pleased with the turn the conversation has taken.
"But to pass from one subject to another," resumes Mr. Smallweed, "to promote the conversation, as a joker might say, to pass, Mr. George, from the ensign to the captain."
"What are you up to now?"
asks Mr. George, pausing with a frown in stroking the recollection of his moustache.
"What captain?"
"Ah, captain. The captain we know of. Captain Hawdon."
"Oh, that's it, is it?"
says Mr. George with a low whistle, as he sees both grandfather and granddaughter looking hard at him.
"You are there. Well, what about it? Come, I won't be smothered any more. Speak."
"My dear friend," returns the old man. "I was applied—" Judy, shake me up a little. "I was applied to yesterday about the captain, and my opinion still is that the captain is not dead."
"Bosh!"
observes Mr. George. "What was your remark, my dear friend?" inquires the old man, with his hand to his ear.
"Bosh!"
"Oh," says Grandfather Smallweed. "Mr. George, of my opinion you can judge for yourself according to the questions asked of me and the reasons given for asking them. Now, what do you think the lawyer making the inquiries wants?"
"A job,"
says Mr. George. "Nothing of the kind."
"Can't be a lawyer, then,"
says Mr. George, folding his arms with an air of confirmed resolution. "My dear friend, he is a lawyer, and a famous one. He wants to see some fragment in Captain Hawdon's writing. He don't want to keep it. He only wants to see it and compare it with a writing in his possession."
Well,
Mr. George, happening to remember the advertisement concerning Captain Hawdon and any information that could be given respecting him, he looked it up and came to me, just as you did, my dear friend. Will you shake hands? So glad you came that day. I should have missed forming such a friendship if you hadn't come."
"Well, Mr. Smallweed,"
says Mr. George again, after going through the ceremony with some stiffness, "I had no such thing. I have nothing but his signature. Plague, pestilence, and famine, battle, murder, and sudden death upon him," says the old man, making a curse out of one of his few remembrances of a prayer and squeezing up his velvet cap between his angry hands. "I have 500,000 of his signatures, I think. But you," breathlessly recovering his mildness of speech as Judy readjusts the cap on his skittle ball of a head, "you, my dear Mr. George, are likely to have some letter or paper that would suit the purpose. Anything would suit the purpose, written in the hand."
"Some writing in that hand," says the trooper, pondering. "Maybe I have."
"My dearest friend."
"Maybe I have not."
"Ho," says Grandfather Smallweed, crestfallen.
"But if I had bushels of it, I would not show as much as would make a cartridge without knowing why."
"Sir, I have told you why. My dear Mr. George, I have told you why."
"Not enough," says the trooper, shaking his head. "I must know more, and approve it."
"Then will you come to the lawyer? My dear friend, will you come and see the gentleman?" urges Grandfather Smallweed, pulling out a lean old silver watch with hands like the leg of a skeleton. "I told him it was probable I might call upon him between 10 and 11 this forenoon, and it's now 10:30. Will you come and see the gentleman, Mr. George?"
"Hmm," says he gravely. "I don't mind that, though why this should concern you so much, I don't know."
"Everything concerns me that has a chance in it of bringing anything to light about him. Didn't he take us all in? Didn't he owe us immense sums all round? Concern me? Who can anything about him concern more than me?" "Not my dear friend," says Grandfather Smallweed, lowering his tone, "that I want you to betray anything. Far from it. Are you ready to come, my dear friend?"
"Aye, I'll come in a moment. I promise nothing, you know."
"No, my dear Mr. George, no."
"And you mean to say you're going to give me a lift to this place, wherever it is, without charging for it?"
Mr. George inquires, getting his hat and thick wash-leather gloves. This pleasantry so tickles Mr. Smallweed that he laughs, long and low, before the fire. But ever while he laughs, he glances over his paralytic shoulder at Mr. George, and eagerly watches him as he unlocks the padlock of a homely cupboard at the distant end of the gallery, looks here and there upon the higher shelves, and ultimately takes something out with a rustling of paper, folds it, and puts it in his breast. Then Judy pokes Mr. Smallweed once, and Mr. Smallweed pokes Judy once.
"I'm ready,"
says the trooper, coming back.
"Phil, you can carry this old gentleman to his coach, and make nothing of him."
"Oh, dear me, oh, Lord, stop a moment," says Mr. Smallweed. "He's so very prompt. Are you sure you can do it carefully, my worthy man?" Phil makes no reply, but seizing the chair and its load, slides away, tightly hugged by the now speechless Mr. Smallweed, and bolts along the passage as if he had an acceptable commission to carry the old gentleman to the nearest volcano. His shorter trust, however, terminating at the cab, he deposits him there, and the fair Judy takes her place beside him, and the chair embellishes the roof, and Mr. George takes the vacant place upon the box.
Mr. George is quite confounded by the spectacle he beholds from time to time, as he peeps into the cab through the window behind him, where the grim Judy is always motionless, and the old gentleman, with his cap over one eye, is always sliding off the seat into the straw, and looking upward at him out of his other eye with a helpless expression of being jolted in the back. Chapter 27 More Old Soldiers Than One. Mr. George has not far to ride with folded arms upon the box, for their destination is Lincoln's Inn Fields. When the driver stops his horses, Mr. George alights, and looking in at the window says,
"What, Mr. Tulkinghorn's your man, is he?"
"Yes, my dear friend. Do you know him, Mr. George?"
"Why, I have heard of him. Seen him, too, I think. But I don't know him, and he don't know me."
There ensues the carrying of Mr. Smallweed upstairs, which is done to perfection with the trooper's help. He is borne into Mr. Tulkinghorn's great room and deposited on the turkey rug before the fire. Mr. Tulkinghorn is not within at the present moment, but will be back directly. The occupant of the pew in the hall, having said thus much, stirs the fire and leaves the triumvirate to warm themselves. Mr. George is mightily curious in respect of the room. He looks up at the painted ceiling, looks round at the old law books, contemplates the portraits of the great clients, reads aloud the names on the boxes.
"Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet,"
Mr. George reads thoughtfully.
"Ha! Manor of Chesney Wold. Hum!"
Mr. George stands looking at these boxes a long while, as if they were pictures, and comes back to the fire, repeating,
"Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, and Manor of Chesney Wold, hey?"
"Worth a mint of money, Mr. George," whispers Grandfather Smallweed, rubbing his legs. "Powerfully rich."
"Who do you mean? This old gentleman or the baronet?"
"This gentleman."
"So I've heard. And knows a thing or two, I'll hold a wager. Not bad quarters, either,"
says Mr. George, looking round again. "See the strong box yonder." This reply is cut short by Mr. Tulkinghorn's arrival. There is no change in him, of course. Rustily dressed, with his spectacles in his hand, and their very case worn threadbare. In manner close and dry, in voice husky and low, in face watchful behind a blind, habitually not uncensorious and contemptuous, perhaps. The peerage may have warmer worshippers and faithfuller believers than Mr. Tulkinghorn, after all, if everything were known.
"Good morning, Mr. Smallweed. Good morning," he says as he comes in. "You have brought the sergeant, I see. Sit down, sergeant."
As Mr. Tulkinghorn takes off his gloves and puts them in his hat, he looks with half-closed eyes across the room to where the trooper stands, and says within himself, perchance, "You'll do, my friend."
"Sit down, sergeant," he repeats as he comes to his table, which is set on one side of the fire, and takes his easy chair. "Cold and raw this morning, cold and raw."
Mr. Tulkinghorn warms before the bars, alternately the palms and knuckles of his hands, and looks, from behind that blind which is always down, at the trio sitting in a little semicircle before him.
"Now, I can feel what I am about,"
as perhaps he can in two senses.
"Mr. Smallweed."
The old gentleman is newly shaken up by Judy to bear his part in the conversation.
"You have brought our good friend the sergeant, I see."
"Yes, sir," returns Mr. Smallweed, very servile to the lawyer's wealth and influence.
"And what does the sergeant say about this business?"
"Mr. George," says Grandfather Smallweed, with a tremulous wave of his shrivelled hand, "this is the gentleman, sir."
Mr. George salutes the gentleman, but otherwise sits bolt upright and profoundly silent, very forward in his chair, as if the full complement of regulation appendages for a field day hung about him. Mr. Tulkinghorn proceeds.
"Well, George, I believe your name is George."
"It is so, sir."
"What do you say, George?"
"I ask your pardon, sir,"
returns the trooper,
"but I should wish to know what you say."
"Do you mean in point of reward?"
"I mean in point of everything, sir."
This is so very trying to Mr. Smallweed's temper that he suddenly breaks out with,
"You're a brimstone beast!"
And as suddenly asks pardon of Mr. Tulkinghorn, excusing himself for this slip of the tongue by saying to Judy,
"I was thinking of your grandmother, my dear."
"I supposed, sergeant," Mr. Tulkinghorn resumes as he leans on one side of his chair and crosses his legs, "that Mr. Smallweed, might have sufficiently explained the matter. It lies in the smallest compass, however. You served under Captain Horton at one time, and were his attendant in illness, and rendered him many little services, and were rather in his confidence, I am told. That is so, is it not?"
"Yes, sir, that is so,"
says Mr. George, with military brevity. "Therefore you may happen to have in your possession something, anything, no matter what, accounts, instructions, orders, a letter, anything, in Captain Horden's writing. I wish to compare his writing with some that I have. If you can give me the opportunity, you shall be rewarded for your trouble. 3, 4, 5 guineas you would consider handsome, I dare say."
"Noble, my dear friend," cries Grandfather Smallweed, screwing up his eyes.
"If not, say how much more, in your conscience as a soldier, you can demand. There is no need for you to part with writing against your inclination, though I should prefer to have it." Mr. George sits squared in exactly the same attitude, looks at the painted ceiling, and says never a word. The irascible Mr. Smallweed scratches the air. "The question is," says Mr. Tulkinghorn, in his methodical, subdued, uninterested way, "first, whether you have any of Captain Horden's writing?"
"First, whether I have any of Captain Horden's writing, sir,"
repeats Mr. George. "Secondly, what will satisfy you for the trouble of producing it?"
"Secondly, what will satisfy me for the trouble of producing it, sir?"
repeats Mr. George. "Thirdly, you can judge for yourself whether it is at all like that," says Mr. Tulkinghorn, suddenly handing him some sheets of written paper tied together.
"Whether it is at all like that, sir, just so,"
repeats Mr. George. All three repetitions Mr. George pronounces in a mechanical manner, looking straight at Mr. Tulkinghorn. Nor does he so much as glance at the affidavit in Jarndyce and Jarndyce that has been given to him for his inspection, though he still holds it in his hand, but continues to look at the lawyer with an air of troubled meditation. "Well," says Mr. Tulkinghorn, "what do you say?"
"Well, sir,"
replies Mr. George, rising erect and looking immense,
"I would rather, if you'll excuse me, have nothing to do with this."
Mr. Tulkinghorn, outwardly quite undisturbed, demands, "Why not?"
"Why, sir,"
returns the trooper,
"except on military compulsion, I am not a man of business. Among civilians, I am what they call in Scotland a ne'er-do-weel. I have no head for papers, sir. I can stand any fire better than a fire across questions. I mentioned to Mr. Smallweed, only an hour or so ago, that when I come into things of this kind, I feel as if I was being smothered, and that is my sensation,"
says Mr. George, looking round upon the company,
"at the present moment."
With that, he takes 3 strides forward to replace the papers on the lawyer's table, and 3 strides backward to resume his former station, where he stands perfectly upright, now looking at the ground, and now at the painted ceiling, with his hands behind him, as if to prevent himself from accepting any other document whatever. Under this provocation, Mr. Smallweed's favourite adjective of disparagement is so close to his tongue that he brings the words, "My dear friend," with the monosyllable "brim," thus converting the possessive pronoun into "brimmy," and appearing to have an impediment in his speech. Once past this difficulty, however, he exhorts his dear friend in the tenderest manner not to be rash, but to do what so eminent a gentleman requires, and to do it with a good grace, confident that it must be unobjectionable as well as profitable. Mr. Tulkinghorn merely utters an occasional sentence, as, "You are the best judge of your own interest, Sergeant. Take care you do no harm by this. Please yourself, please yourself. If you know what you mean, that's quite enough." These he utters with an appearance of perfect indifference as he looks over the papers on his table and prepares to write a letter. Mr. George looks distrustfully from the painted ceiling to the ground, from the ground to Mr. Smallweed, from Mr. Smallweed to Mr. Tulkinghorn, and from Mr. Tulkinghorn to the painted ceiling again, often in his perplexity changing the leg on which he rests.
"I do assure you, sir," says Mr. George, "not to say it offensively, that between you and Mr. Smallweed here, I really am being smothered 50 times over. I really am, sir. I'm not a match for you, gentlemen. Will you allow me to ask why you want to see the captain's hand, in the case that I could find any specimen of it?"
Mr. Tulkinghorn quietly shakes his head. "No. If you were a man of business, Sergeant,
You would not need to be informed that there are confidential reasons, very harmless in themselves, for many such wants in the profession to which I belong. But if you are afraid of doing any injury to Captain Horden, you may set your mind at rest about that.
Aye, he is dead, sir.
Is he? Mr. Tulkinghorn quietly sits down to write.
Well, sir,
says the trooper, looking into his hat after another disconcerted pause,
I'm sorry not to have given you more satisfaction. If it would be any satisfaction to anyone that I should be confirmed in my judgment that I would rather have nothing to do with this by a friend of mine who has a better head for business than I have, and who is an old soldier, I am willing to consult with him. I really am so completely smothered myself at present,
says Mr. George, passing his hand hopelessly across his brow,
that I don't know but what it might be a satisfaction to me.
Mr. Smallweed, hearing that this authority is an old soldier, so strongly inculcates the expediency of the trooper's taking counsel with him, and particularly informing him of its being a question of 5 guineas or more, that Mr. George engages to go and see him. Mr. Tulkinghorn says nothing either way.
"I'll consult my friend, then, by your leave, sir,"
says the trooper,
"and I'll take the liberty of looking in again with a final answer in the course of the day. Mr. Smallweed, if you wish to be carried downstairs—"
"In a moment, my dear friend, in a moment. Will you first let me speak half a word with this gentleman in private?"
"Certainly, sir. Don't hurry yourself on my account."
The trooper retires to a distant part of the room, and resumes his curious inspection of the boxes, strong and otherwise.
"If I wasn't as weak as a brimstone baby, sir," whispers Grandfather Smallweed, drawing the lawyer down to his level by the lapel of his coat, and flashing some half-quenched green fire out of his angry eyes, I tear the writing away from him. He's got it buttoned in his breast. I saw him put it there. Judy saw him put it there. Speak up, you crabbed image, for the sign of a walking-stick shop, and say you saw him put it there."
This vehement conjuration the old gentleman accompanies with such a thrust at his granddaughter that it is too much for his strength, and he slips away out of his chair, drawing Mr. Tulkinghorn with him, until he is arrested by Judy and well shaken.
"Violence will not do for me, my friend," Mr. Tulkinghorn then remarks coolly. "No, no, I know, sir. But it's chafing and galling. It's worse than your smattering, chattering magpie of a grandmother."
To the imperturbable Judy, who only looks at the fire.
"To know he has got what's wanted and won't give it up. He, not to give it up. He, a vagabond. But never mind, sir, never mind. At the most, he has only his own way for a little while. I have him periodically in a vice. I'll twist him, sir. I'll screw him, sir. If he won't do it with a good grace, I'll make him do it with a bad one, sir. Now, my dear Mr. George," says Grandfather Smallweed, winking at the lawyer hideously as he releases him. "I'm ready for your kind assistance, my excellent friend."
Mr. Tulkinghorn, with some shadowy sign of amusement manifesting itself through his self-possession, stands on the hearth-rug with his back to the fire, watching the disappearance of Mr. Smallweed, and acknowledging the trooper's parting salute with one slight nod. It is more difficult to get rid of the old gentleman, Mr. George finds, than to bear a hand in carrying him downstairs, for when he is replaced in his conveyance, he is so loquacious on the subject of the guineas, and retains such an affectionate hold of his button, having in truth a secret longing to rip his coat open and rob him, that some degree of force is necessary on the trooper's part to effect a separation. It is accomplished at last, and he proceeds alone in quest of his adviser. By the Cloisterly Temple, and by Whitefriars, there not without a glance at Hanging Sword Alley, which would seem to be something in his way, and by Blackfriars Bridge and Blackfriars Road, Mr. George sedately marches to a street of little shops lying somewhere in that ganglion of roads from Kent and Surrey, and of streets from the bridges of London, centering in the far-famed Elephant, who has lost his castle, formed of 1,000 four-horse coaches, to a stronger iron monster than he, ready to chop him into mincemeat any day he dares. To one of the little shops in this street, which is a musician's shop, having a few fiddles in the window, and some Pan's pipes, and a tambourine, and a triangle, and certain elongated scraps of music, Mr. George directs his massive tread. and halting at a few paces from it, as he sees a soldierly-looking woman, with her outer skirts tucked up, come forth with a small wooden tub, and in that tub commence a whisking and a splashing on the margin of the pavement, Mr. George says to himself,
"She's as usual, washing greens. I never saw her, except upon a baggage wagon, when she wasn't washing greens."
The subject of this reflection is at all events so occupied in washing greens at present that she remains unsuspicious of Mr. George's approach until, lifting up herself and her tub together when she has poured the water off into the gutter, she finds him standing near her. Her reception of him is not flattering.
"George, I never see you, but I wish you was 100 mile away."
The trooper, without remarking on this welcome, follows into the musical instrument shop, where the lady places her tub of greens upon the counter, and having shaken hands with him, rests her arms upon it.
"I never," she says, "George, consider Matthew Bagnet safe a minute when you're near him. You are that restless and roving."
"Yes, I know I am, Mrs. Bagnet. I know I am."
"You know you are," says Mrs. Bagnet. "What's the use of that? Why are you?"
"The nature of the animal, I suppose,"
returns the trooper good-humouredly.
"Ah!" cries Mrs. Bagnet, something shrilly. "But what satisfaction will the nature of the animal be to me when the animal shall have tempted my mat away from the musical business to New Zealand or Australia?"
Mrs. Bagnet is not at all an ill-looking woman. Rather large-boned, a little coarse in the grain, and freckled by the sun and wind, which have tanned her hair upon the forehead, but healthy, wholesome, and bright-eyed. A strong, busy, active, honest-faced woman of from 45 to 50, clean, hardy, and so economically dressed, though substantially, that the only article of ornament of which she stands possessed appears to be her wedding ring, around which her finger has grown to be so large since it was put on that it will never come off again until it shall mingle with Mrs. Bagnet's dust.
"Mrs. Bagnet,"
says the trooper,
"I'm on my parole with you. Matt will get no harm from me. You may trust me so far."
"Well, I think I may. But the very looks of you are unsettling," Mrs. Bagnet rejoins. "Ah, George, George, if you had only settled down and married Joe Pouch's widow when he died in North America, she'd have combed your hair for you."
"It was a chance for me, certainly,"
returns the trooper, half laughingly, half seriously.
"But I shall never settle down into a respectable man now. Joe Pouch's widow might have done me good. There was something in her and something of her, but I couldn't make up my mind to it. If I'd had the luck to meet with such a wife as Matt found—"
Mrs. Bagnet, who seems in a virtuous way to be under little reserve with a good sort of fellow, but to be another good sort of fellow herself, for that matter, receives this compliment by flicking Mr. George in the face with a head of greens, and taking her tub into the little room behind the shop.
"Why, Quebec, my poppet,"
says George, following on invitation into that department.
"And little Malta, too. Come and kiss your bluffy."
These young ladies, not supposed to have been actually christened by the names applied to them, though always so called in the family from the places of their birth in barracks, are respectively employed on three-legged stools, the younger, some 5 or 6 years old, in learning her letters out of a penny primer, the elder, 8 or 9 perhaps, in teaching her and sewing with great assiduity. Both hail Mr. George with acclamations as an old friend, and after some kissing and romping, plant their stools beside him.
"And how's young Woolwich?"
says Mr. George.
"Ah, there now,"
cries Mrs. Bagnet, turning about from her saucepans, for she is cooking dinner, with a bright flush on her face.
"Would you believe it? Got an engagement at the theatre with his father to play the fife in a military piece."
"Well done, my godson,"
cries Mr. George, slapping his thigh.
"I believe you," says Mrs. Bagnet. "He's a Briton. That's what Woolwich is, a Briton."
"And Matt blows away at his bassoon, and you're respectable civilians, one and all,"
says Mr. George.
"Family people, children growing up, Matt's old mother in Scotland and your old father somewhere else, corresponded with and helped a little, and, well, well, to be sure, I don't know why I shouldn't be wished 100 mile away, for I've not much to do with all this."
Mr. George is becoming thoughtful, sitting before the fire in the whitewashed room, which has a sanded floor and a barrack smell, and contains nothing superfluous, and has not a visible speck of dirt or dust in it, from the faces of Quebec and Malta to the bright tin pots and pannikins upon the dresser shelves. Mr. George is becoming thoughtful, sitting here while Mrs. Bagnet is busy, when Mr. Bagnet and young Woolwich opportunely come home. Mr. Bagnet is an ex-artilleryman, tall and upright, with shaggy eyebrows and whiskers like the fibres of a coconut, not a hair upon his head, and a torrid complexion. His voice, short, deep, and resonant, is not at all unlike the tones of the instrument to which he is devoted. Indeed, there may be generally observed in him an unbending, unyielding, brass-bound air, as if he were himself the bassoon of the human orchestra. Young Woolwich is the type and model of a young drummer. Both father and son salute the trooper heartily, he saying in due season that he has come to advise with Mr. Bagnet. Mr. Bagnet hospitably declares that he will hear of no business until after dinner, and that his friend shall not partake of his counsel without first partaking of boiled pork and greens. The trooper, yielding to this invitation, he and Mr. Bagnet, not to embarrass the domestic preparations, go forth to take a turn up and down the little street, which they promenade with measured tread and folded arms, as if it were a rampart.
"George," says Mr. Bagnet, "you know me. It's my old girl that advises. She has the head. But I never own to it before her. Discipline must be maintained. Wait till the greens is off her mind, then we'll consult. Whatever the old girl says, do. Do it."
"I intend to, Matt,"
replies the other.
"I would sooner take her opinion than that of a college."
"College,"
returns Mr. Bagnet, in short sentences, bassoon-like.
"What college would you leave in another quarter of the world, with nothing but a grey cloak and an umbrella to make its way home to Europe? The old girl would do it tomorrow. Did it once."
"You are right,"
says Mr. George.
"What college," pursues Bagnet, "could you set up in life, with 2 penn'orth of white lime, 1 penn'orth of fuller's earth, 1/2 of sand, and the rest of the change out of 6 pence in money? That's what the old girl started on in the present business."
"I'm rejoiced to hear it's thriving, Matt."
"The old girl," says Mr. Bagnet, acquiescing, "saves, has a stocking somewhere, with money in it. I never saw it, but I know she's got it. Wait till the greens is off her mind, then she'll set you up."
"She is a treasure,"
exclaims Mr. George.
"She's more, but I never owned to it before up. Discipline must be maintained. It was the old girl that brought out my musical abilities. I should have been in the artillery now but for the old girl. 6 years I hammered at the fiddle, 10 at the flute. The old girl said it wouldn't do. Intention good, but want of flexibility. Try the bassoon. The old girl borrowed a bassoon from the bandmaster of the rifle regiment. I practised in the trenches. Got on, got another, get a living by it."
George remarks that she looks as fresh as a rose and as sound as an apple.
"The old girl," says Mr. Bagnet in reply, "is a thoroughly fine woman. Consequently, she is like a thoroughly fine day. Gets finer as she gets on. I never saw the old girl's equal, but I never owned to it before her. Discipline must be maintained."
Proceeding to converse on indifferent matters, they walk up and down the little street, keeping step and time, until summoned by Quebec and Malta to do justice to the pork and greens, over which Mrs. Bagnet, like a military chaplain, says a short grace. In the distribution of these comestibles, as in every other household duty, Mrs. Bagnet develops an exact system, sitting with every dish before her, allotting to every portion of pork its own portion of pot liquor, greens, potatoes, and even mustard, and serving it out complete. Having likewise served out the beer from a can, and thus supplied the mess with all things necessary, Mrs. Bagnet proceeds to satisfy her own hunger, which is in a healthy state. The kit of the mess, if the table furniture may be so denominated, is chiefly composed of utensils of horn and tin that have done duty in several parts of the world. Young Woolwich's knife in particular, which is of the oyster kind, with the additional feature of a strong shutting-up movement which frequently balks the appetite of that young musician, is mentioned as having gone in various hands the complete round of foreign service. The dinner done, Mrs. Bagnet, assisted by the younger branches, who polish their own cups and platters, knives and forks, makes all the dinner garniture shine as brightly as before, and puts it all away, first sweeping the hearth, to the end that Mr. Bagnet and the visitor may not be retarded in the smoking of their pipes. These household cares involve much pattening and counterpattening in the backyard, and considerable use of a pail, which is finally so happy as to assist in the ablutions of Mrs. Bagnet herself. That old girl reappearing by and by, quite fresh, and sitting down to her needlework, then and only then, the greens being only then to be considered as entirely off her mind, Mr. Magnet requests the trooper to state his case. This Mr. George does with great discretion, appearing to address himself to Mr. Bagnet, but having an eye solely on the old girl all the time, as Bagnet has himself. She, equally discreet, busies herself with her needlework. The case fully stated, Mr. Bagnet resorts to his standard artifice for the maintenance of discipline.
"That's the whole of it, is it, George?"
says he.
"That's the whole of it."
"You act according to my opinion?"
"I shall be guided," replies George. "Entirely by it."
"Old girl," says Mr. Bagnet, "give him my opinion. You know it. Tell him what it is."
It is that he cannot have too little to do with people who are too deep for him, and cannot be too careful of interference with matters he does not understand. That the plain rule is to do nothing in the dark, to be a party to nothing underhanded or mysterious, and never to put his foot where he cannot see the ground. This, in effect, is Mr. Bagnet's opinion, as delivered through the old girl, and it so relieves Mr. George's mind by confirming his own opinion and banishing his doubts that he composes himself to smoke another pipe on that exceptional occasion and to have a talk over old times with the whole Bagnet family, according to their various ranges of experience. Through these means it comes to pass that Mr. George does not again rise to his full height in that parlour until the time is drawing on when the bassoon and fife are expected by a British public at the theatre. And as it takes time even then for Mr. George, in his domestic character of Bluffy, to take leave of Quebec and Malta, and insinuate a sponsorial shilling into the pocket of his godson, with felicitations on his success in life, it is dark when Mr. George again turns his face towards Lincoln's Inn Fields.
"A family home," he ruminates as he marches along, "however small it is, makes a man like me look lonely. But it's well I never made that evolution of matrimony. I shouldn't have been fit for it. I'm such a vagabond still, even at my present time of life, that I couldn't hold to the gallery a month together if it was a regular pursuit, or if I didn't camp there gypsy fashion. Come, I disgrace nobody and cumber nobody, that's something. I've not done that for many a long year."
So he whistles it off and marches on. Arrived in Lincoln's Inn Fields, and mounting Mr. Tulkinghorn's stair, he finds the outer door closed and the chambers shut. But the trooper, not knowing much about outer doors, and the staircase being dark besides, he is yet fumbling and groping about, hoping to discover a bell handle, or to open the door for himself, when Mr. Tulkinghorn comes up the stairs, quietly of course, and angrily asks, "Who is that? What are you doing there?"
"Ask your pardon, sir. It's George, the sergeant."
"And couldn't George, the sergeant, see that my door was locked?"
"Why, no, sir, I couldn't. At any rate, I didn't,"
says the trooper, rather nettled. "Have you changed your mind, or are you in the same mind?" Mr. Tulkinghorn demands, but he knows well enough at a glance.
"In the same mind, sir."
"I thought so. That's sufficient. You can go." "So you are the man," says Mr. Tulkinghorn, opening his door with a key, "in whose hiding-place Mr. Gridley was found."
"Yes, I am the man,"
says the trooper, stopping two or three stairs down.
"What then, sir?"
"What then? I don't like your associates. You should not have seen the inside of my door this morning if I had thought of your being that man. Gridley, a threatening, murderous, dangerous fellow." With these words, spoken in an unusually high tone for him, the lawyer goes into his rooms and shuts the door with a thundering noise. Mr. George takes his dismissal in great dudgeon, the greater because a clerk coming up the stairs has heard the last words of all, and evidently applies them to him.
"A pretty character to bear,"
a trooper growls with a hasty oath as he strides downstairs.
"A threatening, murderous, dangerous fellow."
And looking up, he sees the clerk looking down at him and marking him as he passes a lamp. This so intensifies his dudgeon that for 5 minutes he is in an ill humour. But he whistles that off like the rest of it, and marches home to the shooting gallery. Chapter 28. The Ironmaster. Sir Leicester Dedlock has got the better, for the time being, of the family gout, and is once more, in a literal no less than in a figurative point of view, upon his legs. He's at his place in Lincolnshire, but the waters are out again on the low-lying grounds, and the cold and damp steal into Chesney Wold, though well defended, and eke into Sir Leicester's bones. The blazing fires of faggot and coal, Deadlock timber and antediluvian forest, that blaze upon the broad, wide hearths, and wink in the twilight on the frowning woods, sullen to see how trees are sacrificed, do not exclude the enemy. The hot water pipes that trail themselves all over the house, the cushioned doors and windows, and the screens and curtains fail to supply the fire's deficiencies, and to satisfy Sir Leicester's need. Hence the fashionable intelligence proclaims one morning to the listening earth that Lady Dedlock is expected shortly to return to town for a few weeks. It is a melancholy truth that even great men have their poor relations. Indeed, great men have often more than their fair share of poor relations, inasmuch as very red blood of the superior quality, like inferior blood unlawfully shed, will cry aloud and will be heard. Sir Leicester's cousins, in the remotest degree, are so many murders in the respect that they will out. Among whom there are cousins who are so poor that one might almost dare to think it would have been the happier for them never to have been plated links upon the Dedlock chain of gold, but to have been made of common iron at first and done base service. Service, however, with a few limited reservations, genteel but not profitable, they may not do, being of the Dedlock dignity. So they visit their richer cousins, and get into debt when they can, and live but shabbily when they can't, and find the women no husbands, and the men no wives, and ride in borrowed carriages, and sit at feasts that are never of their own making, and so go through high life. The rich family sum has been divided by so many figures, and they are the something over that nobody knows what to do with. Everybody on Sir Leicester Dedlock's side of the question, and of his way of thinking, would appear to be his cousin, more or less. From my Lord Boodle, through the Duke of Foodle, down to Noodle, Sir Leicester, like a glorious spider, stretches his threads of relationship. But while he is stately in the cousinship of the everybody's, he is a kind and generous man, according to his dignified way, in the cousinship of the nobody's. And at the present time, in despite of the damp, he stays out of the visit of several such cousins at Chesney Wold with the constancy of a martyr. Of these, foremost in the front rank stands Volumnia Dedlock, a young lady of 60, who is doubly highly related, having the honour to be a poor relation by the mother's side to another great family. Miss Volumnia, displaying in early life a pretty talent for cutting ornaments out of coloured paper, and also for singing to the guitar in the Spanish tongue, and propounding French conundrums in country houses, passed the 20 years of her existence between 20 and 40 in a sufficiently agreeable manner. Lapsing then out of date, and being considered to bore mankind by her vocal performances in the Spanish language, she retired to Bath, where she lives slenderly on an annual present from Sir Leicester, and whence she makes occasional resurrections in the country houses of her cousins. She has an extensive acquaintance at Bath, among appalling old gentlemen with thin legs and nankeen trousers, and is of high standing in that dreary city. But she is a little dreaded elsewhere, in consequence of an indiscreet profusion in the article of rouge, and persistency in an obsolete pearl necklace like a rosary of little birds' eggs. In any country in a wholesome state, Volumnia would be a clear case for the pension list. Efforts have been made to get her on it. And when William Buffy came in, it was fully expected that her name would be put down for a couple of hundred a year. But William Buffy somehow discovered, contrary to all expectation, that these were not the times when it could be done, and this was the first clear indication Sir Leicester Dedlock had conveyed to him that the country was going to pieces. There is likewise the Honourable Bob Stables, who can make warm mashes with the skill of a veterinary surgeon, and is a better shot than most gamekeepers. He has been for some time particularly desirous to serve his country in a post of good emoluments, unaccompanied by any trouble or responsibility. In a well-regulated body politic, this natural desire on the part of a spirited young gentleman so highly connected would be speedily recognised, but somehow William Buffy found when he came in that these were not times in which he could manage that little matter either, and this was the second indication Sir Leicester Dedlock had conveyed to him that the country was going to pieces. The rest of the cousins are ladies and gentlemen of various ages and capacities, the major part amiable and sensible, and likely to have done well enough in life if they could have overcome their cousinship. As it is, they are almost all a little worsted by it, and lounge in purposeless and listless paths, and seem to be quite as much at a loss how to dispose of themselves as anybody else can be how to dispose of them. In this society, and where not, my Lady Dedlock reigns supreme. Beautiful, elegant, accomplished, and powerful in her little world, for the world of fashion does not stretch all the way from pole to pole, her influence in Sir Leicester's house, however haughty and indifferent her manner, is greatly to improve and refine it. The cousins, even those older cousins who were paralyzed when Sir Leicester married her, do her feudal homage. And the Honourable Bob Stables daily repeats to some chosen person between breakfast and lunch his favourite original remark, that she is the best groomed woman in the whole stud. Such the guests in the long drawing-room at Chesney Wold this dismal night, when the step on the Ghost's Walk, inaudible here, however, might be the step of a deceased cousin shut out in the cold. It is near bedtime. Bedroom fires blaze brightly all over the house, raising ghosts of grim furniture on wall and ceiling. Bedroom candlesticks bristle on the distant table by the door, and cousins yawn on ottomans. Cousins at the piano, cousins at the soda-water tray, cousins rising from the card table, cousins gathered round the fire. Standing on one side of his own peculiar fire, for there are two, Sir Leicester. On the opposite side of the broad hearth, my lady at her table. Volumnia, as one of the more privileged cousins, in a luxurious chair between them. Sir Leicester glancing, with magnificent displeasure, at the rouge and the pearl necklace.
"I occasionally meet on my staircase here,"
drawls Volumnia, whose thoughts perhaps are already hopping up it to bed, after a long evening of very desultory talk.
"One of the prettiest girls, I think, that I ever saw in my life."
"A protégé of my lady's,"
observes Sir Leicester.
"I thought so. I felt sure that some uncommon eye must have picked that girl out. She really is a marvel." "A dolly sort of beauty, perhaps,"
says Miss Volumnia, reserving her own sort,
"but in its way perfect. Such bloom I never saw."
Sir Leicester, with his magnificent glance of displeasure at the rouge, appears to say so too. "Indeed," remarks my lady languidly, "if there is any uncommon eye in the case, it is Mrs. Rouncewell's and not mine. Rosa is her discovery."
"Your maid, I suppose?"
"No. My anything. Pet. Secretary, messenger, I don't know what."
"You would like to have her about you, as you would like to have a flower, or a bird, or a picture, or a poodle. No, not a poodle, though. Or anything else that was equally pretty,"
says Volumnia, sympathizing.
"Yes, how charming now. And how well that delightful old soul, Mrs. Rouncewell, is looking. She must be an immense age, and yet she is as active and handsome. She is the dearest friend I have, positively."
Sir Leicester feels it to be right and fitting that the housekeeper of Chesney Wold should be a remarkable person. Apart from that, he has a real regard for Mrs. Rouncewell and likes to hear her praised, so he says,
"You are right, Volumnia,"
which Volumnia is extremely glad to hear.
"She has no daughter of her own, has she?"
"Mrs. Rouncewell?" "No, Volumnia. She has a son. Indeed, she has two."
My lady, whose chronic malady of boredom has been sadly aggravated by Volumnia this evening, glances wearily towards the candlesticks and heaves a noiseless sigh.
"And it is a remarkable example of the confusion into which the present age has fallen, of the obliteration of landmarks, the opening of floodgates, and the uprooting of distinctions,"
says Sir Leicester with stately gloom,
"that I have been informed by Mr. Tulkinghorn that Mrs. Rouncewell's son has been invited to go into Parliament."
Miss Volumnia utters a little sharp scream.
"Yes, indeed," repeats Sir Leicester. "Into Parliament. I never heard of such a thing. Good gracious, what is the man?"
exclaims Volumnia.
"He is called, I believe, an ironmaster."
Sir Leicester says it slowly, and with gravity and doubt, as not being sure but that he is called a lead mistress, or that the right word may be some other word expressive of some other relationship to some other metal. Volumnia utters another little scream.
"He has declined the proposal, if my information from Mr. Tulkinghorn be correct, as I have no doubt it is, Mr. Tulkinghorn being always correct and exact. Still, that does not," says Sir Leicester, "that does not lessen the anomaly, which is fraught with strange considerations, startling considerations, as it appears to me."
Miss Volumnia rising with a look candlestickwards, Sir Leicester politely performs the grand tour of the drawing-room, brings one, and lights it at my lady's shaded lamp.
"I must beg you, my lady," he says while doing so, "to remain a few moments, for this individual of whom I speak arrived this evening shortly before dinner, and requested in a very becoming note."
Sir Leicester, with his habitual regard to truth, dwells upon it.
"I am bound to say, in a very becoming and well-expressed note, the favour of a short interview with yourself and myself on the subject of this young girl. As it appeared that he wished to depart to-night, I replied that we would see him before retiring."
Miss Volumnia, with a third little scream, takes flight, wishing her hosts, oh lad, well rid of the, what is it, ironmaster. The other cousins soon disperse, to the last cousin there. Sir Leicester rings the bell.
"Make my compliments to Mr. Rouncewell in the housekeeper's apartments, and say I can receive him now."
My lady, who has heard all this with slight attention outwardly, looks towards Mr. Rouncewell as he comes in. He is a little over 50, perhaps, of a good figure, like his mother, and has a clear voice, a broad forehead from which his dark hair has retired, and a shrewd, though open, face. He is a responsible-looking gentleman, dressed in black, portly enough, but strong and active. He has a perfectly natural and easy air, and is not in the least embarrassed by the great presence into which he comes. "Sir Leicester and Lady Dedlock, as I have already apologized for intruding on you, I cannot do better than be very brief. I thank you, Sir Leicester." The head of the Dedlocks has motioned towards a sofa between himself and my lady. Mr. Rouncewell quietly takes his seat there. "In these busy times, when so many great undertakings are in progress, people like myself have so many workmen in so many places that we are always on the flight." Sir Leicester is content enough that the ironmaster should feel that there is no hurry there. There, in that ancient house, rooted in that quiet park, where the ivy and the moss have had time to mature, and the gnarled and warted elms and the umbrageous oaks stand deep in the fern and leaves of 100 years, and where the sundial on the terrace has dumbly recorded for centuries that time which was as much the property of every Dedlock, while he lasted, as the house and lands. Sir Leicester sits down in an easy chair, opposing his repose and that of Chesney Wold to the restless flights of ironmasters. "Lady Dedlock has been so kind," proceeds Mr. Rouncewell, with a respectful glance and a bow that way, "as to place near her a young beauty of the name of Rosa. Now, my son has fallen in love with Rosa, and has asked my consent to his proposing marriage to her and to their becoming engaged, if she will take him, which I suppose she will. I have never seen Rosa until today, but I have some confidence in my son's good sense, even in love. I find her what he represents her, to the best of my judgment, and my mother speaks of her with great commendation."
"She in all respects deserves it," says my lady.
"I am happy, Lady Dedlock, that you say so, and I need not comment on the value to me of your kind opinion of her."
"That,"
observes Sir Leicester with unspeakable grandeur, for he thinks the ironmaster a little too glib,
"must be quite unnecessary."
"Quite unnecessary, Sir Leicester. Now my son is a very young man, and Rosa is a very young woman. As I made my way, so my son must make his, and his being married at present is out of the question. But supposing I gave my consent to his engaging himself to this pretty girl, if this pretty girl will engage herself to him, I think it a piece of candour to say at once, I'm sure, Sir Leicester and Lady Dedlock, you will understand and excuse me, I should make it a condition that she did not remain at Chesney Wold. Therefore, before communicating further with my son, I take the liberty of saying that if her removal would be in any way inconvenient or objectionable, I will hold the matter over with him for any reasonable time, and leave it precisely where it is." Not remain at Chesney Wold. Make it a condition. All Sir Leicester's old misgivings relative to Wat Tyler and the people in the iron districts who do nothing but turn out by torchlight come in a shower upon his head, the fine grey hair of which, as well as of his whiskers, actually stirs with indignation.
"Am I to understand, sir?" says Sir Leicester. "And is my lady to understand?"
He brings her in thus specially, first as a point of gallantry, and next as a point of prudence, having great reliance on her sense,
Am I to understand, Mr. Rouncewell, and is my lady to understand, sir, that you consider this young woman too good for Chesney Wold, or likely to be injured by remaining here?
Certainly not, Sir Leicester.
I am glad to hear it, Sir Leicester, very lofty indeed.
Pray, Mr. Rouncewell, says my lady, warning Sir Leicester off with the slightest gesture of her pretty hand, as if he were a fly, explain to me what you mean.
Willingly, Lady Dedlock. There is nothing I could desire more.
Addressing her composed face, whose intelligence, however, is too quick and active to be concealed by any studied impassiveness, however habitual to the strong Saxon face of the visitor, a picture of resolution and perseverance, my lady listens with attention, occasionally slightly bending her head.
I am the son of your housekeeper, Lady Dedlock, and passed my childhood about this house. My mother has lived here half a century, and will die here, I have no doubt. She is one of those examples, perhaps as good a one as there is, of love and attachment and fidelity in such a nation, which England may well be proud of, but of which no order can appropriate the whole pride or the whole merit, because such an instance bespeaks high worth on two sides, on the great side assuredly, on the small one no less assuredly.
Sir Leicester snorts a little to hear the law laid down in this way, but in his honour and his love of truth he freely, though silently, admits the justice of the ironmaster's proposition.
Pardon me for saying what is so obvious, but I wouldn't have it hastily supposed, with the least turn of his eyes towards Sir Leicester, that I am ashamed of my mother's position here, or wanting in all just respect for Chesney Wold and the family. I certainly may have desired, I certainly have desired, Lady Dedlock, that my mother should retire after so many years and end her days with me. But as I have found that to sever this strong bond would be to break her heart, I have long abandoned that idea.
Sir Leicester, very magnificent again at the notion of Mrs. Rouncewell being spirited off from her natural home to end her days with an ironmaster.
"I have been," proceeds the visitor in a modest, clear way, "an apprentice and a workman. I have lived on workman's wages years and years, and beyond a certain point have had to educate myself. My wife was a foreman's daughter and plainly brought up. We have three daughters besides this son of whom I have spoken, and being fortunately able to give them greater advantages than we have had ourselves, we have educated them well, very well. It has been one of our great cares and pleasures to make them worthy of any station."
A little boastful in his fatherly tone here, as if he added in his heart, "even of the Chesney Wold station." Not a little more magnificence, therefore, on the part of Sir Leicester.
All this is so frequent, Lady Dedlock, where I live, and among the class to which I belong, that what would be generally called unequal marriages are not of such rare occurrence with us as elsewhere. A son will sometimes make it known to his father that he has fallen in love, say, with a young woman in the factory. The father, who once worked in a factory himself, will be a little disappointed at first, very possibly. It may be that he had other views for his son. However, the chances are that having ascertained the young woman to be of unblemished character, he will say to his son, "I must be quite sure you are in earnest here. This is a serious matter for both of you. Therefore I shall have this girl educated for 2 years. Or it may be, I shall place this girl at the same school with your sisters for such a time, during which you will give me your word and honour to see her only so often. If at the expiration of that time, when she has so far profited by her advantages as that you may be upon a fair equality, you are both in the same mind, I will do my part to make you happy. I know of several cases such as I describe, my lady, and I think they indicate to me my own course now."
Sir Leicester's magnificence explodes, calmly but terribly.
"Mr. Rouncewell,"
says Sir Leicester, with his right hand in the breast of his blue coat, the attitude of state in which he is painted in the gallery,
"do you draw a parallel between Chesney Wold and a—"
here he resists a disposition to choke—
"a factory?"
"I need not reply, Sir Leicester, that the two places are very different, but for the purposes of this case I think a parallel may be justly drawn between them." Sir Leicester directs his majestic glance down one side of the long drawing-room, and up the other, before he can believe that he is awake.
"Are you aware, sir, that this young woman whom my lady, has placed near her person, was brought up at the village school outside the gates?"
Sir Leicester, I'm quite aware of it. A very good school it is, and handsomely supported by this family.
Then, Mr. Rouncewell, returned Sir Leicester, the application of what you have said is, to me, incomprehensible.
Will it be more comprehensible, Sir Leicester, if I say, the ironmaster is reddening a little, that I do not regard the village school as teaching everything desirable to be known by my son's wife? From the village school of Chesney Wold, intact as it is this minute, to the whole framework of society. From the whole framework of society to the aforesaid framework receiving tremendous cracks in consequence of people, ironmasters, lead mistresses and what not minding their catechism, and getting out of the station unto which they are called, necessarily and forever, according to Sir Leicester's rapid logic, the first station in which they happen to find themselves, and from that to their educating other people out of their stations, and so obliterating the landmarks, and opening the floodgates, and all the rest of it. This is the swift progress of the Dedlock mind.
My lady, I beg your pardon. Permit me for one moment.
She has given a faint indication of intending to speak.
Mr. Rouncewell, our views of duty, and our views of station, and our views of education, and our views of... In short, all our views are so diametrically opposed that to prolong this discussion must be repellent to your feelings, and repellent to my own. This young woman is honoured with my lady's notice and favour. If she wishes to withdraw herself from that notice and favour, or if she chooses to place herself under the influence of any one who may, in his peculiar opinions, he will allow me to say in his peculiar opinions, though I readily admit that he is not accountable for them to me, who may, in his peculiar opinions, withdraw her from that notice and favour, she is at any time at liberty to do so. We are obliged to you for the plainness with which you have spoken. It will have no effect of itself, one way or other, on the young woman's position here. Beyond this we can make no terms, and here we beg, if you will be so good, to leave the subject.
The visitor pauses a moment to give my lady an opportunity, but she says nothing. He then rises and replies, Sir Leicester and Lady Dedlock, allow me to thank you for your attention, and only to observe that I shall very seriously recommend my son to conquer his present inclinations. Good night.
Mr. Rouncewell,
says Sir Leicester, with all the nature of a gentleman shining in him.
It is late, and the roads are dark. I hope your time is not so precious, but that you will allow my lady and myself to offer you the hospitality of Chesney Wold, for tonight, at least.
I hope so, adds my lady. I'm much obliged to you, but I have to travel all night in order to reach a distant part of the country punctually at an appointed time in the morning. Therewith the ironmaster takes his departure, Sir Leicester ringing the bell, and my lady rising as he leaves the room. When my lady goes to her boudoir, she sits down thoughtfully by the fire, and, inattentive to the ghost's walk, looks at Rosa writing in an inner room. Presently my lady calls her. Come to me, child. Tell me the truth. Are you in love? Oh, my lady. My lady, looking at the downcast and blushing face, says, smiling, Who is it? Is it Mrs. Rouncewell's grandson? Yes, if you please, my lady, but I don't know that I am in love with him, yet. Yet? You silly little thing. Do you know that he loves you, yet? I think he likes me a little, my lady. And Rosa bursts into tears. Is this Lady Dedlock standing beside the village beauty, smoothing her dark hair with that motherly touch, and watching her with eyes so full of musing interest? Aye, indeed it is. Listen to me, child. You are young and true, and I believe you are attached to me. Indeed I am, my lady. Indeed there is nothing in the world I wouldn't do to show how much. And I don't think you would wish to leave me just yet, Rosa, even for a lover? No, my lady. Oh, no. Rosa looks up for the first time, quite frightened at the thought. Confide in me, my child. Don't fear me. I wish you to be happy, and will make you so, if I can make anybody happy on this earth. Rosa, with fresh tears, kneels at her feet and kisses her hand. My lady takes the hand with which she has caught it, and standing with her eyes fixed on the fire, puts it about and about between her own two hands, and gradually lets it fall. Seeing her so absorbed, Rosa softly withdraws, but still my lady's eyes are on the fire. In search of what? Of any hand that is no more, of any hand that never was, of any touch that might have magically changed her life? Or does she listen to the ghost's walk and think what step does it most resemble? A man's? A woman's? The pattering of a little child's feet ever coming on, on, on. Some melancholy influence is upon her. Or why should so proud a lady close the doors and sit alone upon the hearth so desolate? Volumnia is away next day, and all the cousins are scattered before dinner. Not a cousin of the batch, but is amazed to hear from Sir Leicester at breakfast-time of the obliteration of landmarks and opening of floodgates, and cracking of the framework of society manifested through Mrs. Rouncewell's son. Not a cousin of the batch, but is really indignant, and connects it with the feebleness of William Buffy when in office, and really does feel deprived of a stake in the country, or the pension list, or something, by fraud and wrong. As to Volumnia, she is handed down the great staircase by Sir Leicester, as eloquent upon the theme as if there were a general rising in the north of England to obtain her rouge pot and pearl necklace. And thus, with a clatter of maids and valets, for it is one appurtenance of their cousinship that however difficult they may find it to keep themselves, they must keep maids and valets, the cousins disperse to the four winds of heaven, and the one wintry wind that blows to-day shakes a shower from the trees near the deserted house, as if all the cousins had been changed into leaves. Chapter 29. The Young Man. Chesney Wold is shut up. Carpets are rolled into great scrolls in corners of comfortless rooms. Bright damask does penance in brown holland. Carving and gilding puts on mortification, and the Dedlock ancestors retire from the light of day again. Around and around the house the leaves fall thick, but never fast, for they come circling down with a dead lightness that is sombre and slow. Let the gardener sweep and sweep the turf as he will, and press the leaves into full barrows and wheel them off, still they lie ankle-deep. Howls the shrill wind round Chesney Wold. The sharp rain beats, the windows rattle, and the chimneys growl. Mists hide in the avenues, veil the points of view, and move in funeral-wise across the rising grounds. On all the house there is a cold, blank smell, like the smell of a little church, though something drier, suggesting that the dead and buried Dedlocks walk there in the long nights and leave the flavour of their graves behind them. But the house in town, which is rarely in the same mind as Chesney Wold at the same time, seldom rejoicing when it rejoices, or mourning when it mourns, expecting when a Dedlock dies, the house in town shines out awakened. As warm and bright as so much state may be, as delicately redolent of pleasant scents that bear no trace of winter as hot-house flowers can make it, soft and hushed, so that the ticking of the clocks and the crisp burning of the fires alone disturb the stillness in the rooms. It seems to wrap those chilled bones of Sir Leicester's in rainbow-coloured wool. And Sir Leicester is glad to repose in dignified contentment before the great fire in the library, condescendingly perusing the backs of his books, or honouring the fine arts with a glance of approbation. For he has his pictures, ancient and modern, some of the fancy ball school in which art occasionally descends to become a master, which would be best catalogued, like the miscellaneous articles in a sale, as 3 high-backed chairs, a table and cover, long-necked bottle containing wine, 1 flask, 1 Spanish female's costume, 3-quarter face portrait of Miss Jog, the model, and a suit of armour containing Don Quixote, or 1 stone terrace, cracked, 1 gondola in distance, 1 Venetian senator's dress, complete, richly embroidered white satin costume with profile portrait of Miss Jog, the model, 1 scimitar, superbly mounted in gold, with jewelled handle, elaborate Moorish dress, very rare, and Othello. Mr. Tulkinghorn comes and goes pretty often, there being estate business to do, leases to be renewed, and so on. He sees my lady pretty often, too, and he and she are as composed and as indifferent, and take as little heed of one another as ever. Yet it may be that my lady fears this Mr. Tulkinghorn, and that he knows it. It may be that he pursues her doggedly and steadily, with no touch of compunction, remorse, or pity. It may be that her beauty, and all the state and brilliancy surrounding her only gives him the greater zest for what he is set upon, and makes him the more inflexible in it. Whether he be cold and cruel, whether immovable in what he has made his duty, whether absorbed in love of power, whether determined to have nothing hidden from him in ground where he has burrowed among secrets all his life, whether he in his heart despises the splendour of which he is a distant beam, whether he is always treasuring up slights and offences in the affability of his gorgeous clients, whether he be any of this, or all of this, it may be that my lady had better have 5,000 pairs of fashionable eyes upon her in distrustful vigilance, than the 2 eyes of this rusty lawyer with his wisp of neckcloth and his dull black breeches tied with ribbons at the knees. Sir Leicester sits in my lady's room, that room in which Mr. Tulkinghorn read the affidavit in Jarndyce and Jarndyce, particularly complacent. My lady, as on that day, sits before the fire with her screen in her hand. Sir Leicester is particularly complacent because he has found in his newspaper some congenial remarks bearing directly on the floodgates and the framework of